technologies. And this is kind of the introductory slide. You heard a lot from Zach, I think that was last time, like a week ago or 2 weeks ago, about microarray technology. And I'm sure that he gave an extremely inspirational and enthusiastic talk about the possibilities and scope of this technology. But let me give you just a little slide. So whenever a new technology appears, or for example, microarray technology or the genome project, of course, first there is a general ebullience and optimism that all problems will be solved within a couple of years. There are lots of reasons for this optimism. One is that you want investors in your company and you want public funding. But of course, in a couple of months or years, realistic expectations start to appear, and then you have to start to think about limitations of the actual technology. And actually, that's the reason that we have a talk about this very topic. So when we talk about limitations of the technology, we have to define what you actually want to do in science. I mean, of course, there are lots of various definitions of science, but in a sense, you would like to make predictions about some sort of a system. And we are going to talk about limitations in those terms. How is it going to limit your predictive power? So when you talk about limitations, you can talk about how accurate your measurements. There are limitations of the accuracy of the measurements, accuracy and noise. But there are limitations in terms of sensitivity. What are you measuring? How complete is your measurement? And of course, I'm going to be very briefly touching on this, that even if you measure everything very accurately, there are inherent limitations in your predictive power. You cannot predict everything. Think about unpredictability in terms of chaos. Even if you measure everything very precisely, there are systems that you simply cannot predict how it's going to behave in an analytic way. So noise. First, I'd like to define what is noise and what is signal. Noise is an inherent feature of complex systems. Noise in continuous and discrete measurements. Noise is the limitations of the technology. And of course, we need to talk about what can be done about noise. That's what statistics was invented for. And I'm going to talk about briefly about normalization. So what is noise? There are different definitions. This is, I of course, took from Webster. And let's just look at this point E, which is an irrelevant or meaningless data or output occurring along with desired information. Now, you should be aware of that noise is not always a bad thing. Sometimes noise may turn out to be a very important signal. So, what is your background? I'm just
biology.
Sorry?
Medicine.
Okay. So this is probably not the best example for you, but there were two guys, two radio astronomers, many years ago. I think now it's almost 50 years ago, who were looking for signals, and they just saw this noise coming from every direction in the universe as radio astronomers, and that turned out to be the cosmic background radiation, which is one of the most important discoveries. And these guys actually got the Nobel Prize a couple of years later. That was starting with pure noise, and they were trying to get rid of that noise. They couldn't, and that led to discovery of the cosmic background radiation. But if you think about medicine, then for example, the way cisplatinum was discovered as a chemotherapeutic agent, what happened is actually that the electrodes that they were using in those experiments contained platinum, and they saw the effect of. Come in. Are you here? Okay. Actually, I just wanted to close the door because I didn't know what the noise. So, and then they tried to figure out what was killing the cells, what was slowing down the growth, and then they realized that actually it was the platinum containing those electrodes, and this is the way they discovered cisplatinum. So the point is that noise is not always a bad thing. Now, what we perceive as noise or error in measurements, in biological measurements, might be a key component of biological processes. So, of course, mutations in evolution are extremely important. When we will talk about discrete measurements, one form of that is actually when you are sequencing, you see lots of noise in the human or all sorts of genomes. That's called junk DNA. Well, we do not really know what this junk DNA is for. Then, no, just go ahead. That's I shouldn't have said go ahead. It's still the introduction. So, we do not really know. You perceive as junk DNA when you are trying to find genes or exons or introns or transcription factor binding sites. And it's going to be extremely, it's going to bother you very much when you're trying to find these true signals in a genome. We do not really know what junk DNA is for, but there might be a good reason it's there. It might be determining the spatial distance of different genes or whatnot. Another type of noise is, which seems to be very important, is during differentiation. Very often you see an asymmetric cell division. So RNA or proteins are divided or distributed between the two daughter cells asymmetrically. And that is actually done, or that happens, more or less by chance. And the two daughter cells are going to go one way or another depending on what sort of, how much RNA or protein they got. This you can perceive as some sort of a noise measurement if you do a single cell measurement. And stochastic fluctuations may be very important for the stability of complex physicochemical systems. I might be talking about stochastic genetic networks and robustness much later in April when I may be talking about modeling. And let's suffice now that stochasticity and noise in complex systems might be a very important feature to maintain the stability of that system. You should be aware of that, of course, that genetic networks and in general biological system are stochastic systems because you know that, for example, you have only a couple of hundred copies of a given transcription factor per nucleus, or even less. Sometimes you have only 50 per nucleus. The intercellular environment is not a free solution, and reaction kinetics is often slow. And what it means that we have a stochastic system in this case, that if you have a completely deterministic system, then from any given gene expression pair on any given state, you can go to one state, to one another state. That's a deterministic system. Whereas in a stochastic system, from any given state, you can go to different states with a certain probability. So that's what we mean by stochastic systems. Now, if you have this, you have a stochastic system in biology, then when you are measuring gene expression levels, or protein expression levels, or any activity of any biological parameters, you will perceive that as a noise in your measurement. Now, is it true, or is it this is really relevant to biology, that you have stochasticity present in the system? And this was a paper that came out now almost 2 years ago, when actually they wanted to measure this. This was done in bacteria, but recently similar studies were published in yeast as well. And what they did, they took two proteins from E. coli, and they put on a green, two different GFP, two different green fluorescent proteins. And so they could measure the expression level of two proteins. And they set up the system in a way that if it was deterministic, then it was under the very same promoter. Both genes were expressed or driven by the very same promoter, and it was a very carefully set up experiment. So if the system was deterministic, then what they expected, that the expression ratio of those two proteins is going to be the same in every single cell. Now, what they found, that despite all their efforts to set up the experiment as perfectly as possible, they found that the two different colors, that means in this here it's red and green, but of course these are only false coloring. The point is that you have two different wavelengths where these signals are emitted. Depending on the actual cell, you can have very green, very red, and some yellow cells as well. Which means that despite the careful way of this system, of this experiment was set up, these cells expressed the two proteins at a different ratio, and that was due to stochasticity. So the point is that stochastic fluctuations occur in living organisms. They are trying to understand now pretty hard what's the relevance of this. It seems that it has a lot of relevance, but of course we are not quite sure what the implications are. You should be aware of that whenever you do a biological measurement, or what, especially I mean, these days technology might develop, you're always measuring population average data. So this is, again, is going to add to your noise. When you're measuring gene expression levels or do proteomics, you of course grind down millions of cells or tens of thousands of cells, and that is going to be giving you a certain level of noise as well. And this is even true. This is true even if single cells are quantified. The reason for that is that if you have a stochastic network, and let's imagine that you can really measure gene expression levels. You can do this for, of course, individual proteins in single cells. But whenever you still do your measurement, you usually interfere with the cell or you kill the cell. So you don't really know how would that cell have progressed. So since you interfere with the system and it's a stochastic system, you can't really figure out what would have happened in the system. So you're actually you're going to end up with a population average data again. So there is no measurement without noise, as you know. It is usually the accuracy sensitivity of your measurement. And that is, I'm sure that most of you would be extremely troubled if you did a microarray measurement or some sort of a chemical or biological measurement, and in three triplicates you would get exactly the very same number. That would mean probably to most of you that there is some sort of a systematic error in your whatever you're doing, your photometer or whatnot, because you would expect some sort of a spread of your continuous data. So it is expected for continuous variables to have data with a certain spread. And you know that that's okay, and that's why statistics was invented. But you know that there is some sort of a true value of your measurement. But due to little fluctuations and whatnot, you will have a certain spread around that true variable. And of course, the question is, and that's what statistics, at least frequent statistics, is really concerned with, that did the variable change due to a Grevian treatment whenever you have a spread like that? So if you have a measurement here or here or here, and this is your starting point, then what's the probability that your parameter really changed its value? So what you need to do for this is you need to have, of course, lots of measurements and or a fairly good idea about the nature of the noise. That's very important as well. We are not going to get into this now, but as you know, that, for example, the easiest or one of the most convenient assumptions is that you have a normal distribution. It's good to have that, because if you have that, then you can actually make very simple calculations about the probability that whether your mean or whether your parameter is actually changed or not. So statistics was invented a long time ago, and actually partly it was due to biological measurement. And so statistics is concerned in biology with many, many different issues. One of it is, what is the true value of a given parameter, if there is one true value? There is a very frequently used analysis that people or biologists are not really aware of, which is kind of a Bayesian analysis. And actually this is the most frequently done statistical analysis in biology. This is the way all science works. I have a certain belief about whether something is going to happen, or for example, an oncogene is going to transform a cell or not. I make a statement, and my job is actually to convince you, or other biologists, that this is actually true. Now, what you usually do is actually you repeat the experiment, and if you see the same phenomenon, then you are kind of updating your we are going to update our common belief what I was saying, that was actually true. So sort of Bayesian statistics is always there in a kind of in a hidden way in all biological arguing. We are trying to update each other's belief network regarding biology. The third type of statistical analysis is that you don't really believe the measurements, but you know that there is some sort of a systematic error there. And then you try to correct for this systematic error, and that's what's called normalization, and I'm going to talk about that in details there. And there is a fourth issue in statistics when you actually producing a lot of measurements. So you're looking for certain patterns. Imagine that you're looking for gene expression changes that is going to cause cancer. And you have two populations of your samples, normal and cancer. And you see that certain type of genes are always downregulated or upregulated or mutated in cancer. Now, this could happen by chance. If you do not have a large number of samples, and this change is actually simply random, so in a certain cells it's up, in other cells it's down, then if you have the wrong number of samples, then it might happen that just by chance, with a certain probability, in all normal samples that mutation is not present, and in all disease samples or all cancer samples it's going to be present. So what you need to ask is that, can that pattern that would explain your biology be present by chance? And this is kind of, there are too many numbers. And what you can do is actually you can try to solve analytically. That's what combinatorics is about. Or you can do some sort of permutation. And as you'll see later, that's actually a pretty nasty problem when you're trying to apply it for real life problems. So biological measurements are often expensive, and I should probably, I mean, this is something I'd like to point out to you, that if you follow the literature, or when you will start to read the literature, and I'm assuming you will, because that's why you're taking this course, you will see lots of Nature, Science, and high profile papers in which they ran a single microarray measurement on a large number of different cancer samples. And then they are drawing, they're drawing all sorts of conclusions about which genes are important in cancer, which ones not. And these measurements have been and are still rather expensive, and it's not easy to come by, not easy to obtain the samples. But you should be aware of that. You cannot really do any statistics on that. You should do some sort of a Bayesian type of statistics, but whatever they are doing on this is not really statistics. It's going to be Bayesian. I'm just going to say that I see this change very often, and you either believe it or not, but you can't really get any hardcore numbers out of it that you can use for any sort of statistical analysis or modeling. So reliable numbers cannot be produced without replicates, which is kind of obvious. So the central problem is that in massive parabiological measurements, quantitative and qualitative calls are supposed to be made on a large number of heterogeneous variables using only a few replicates. That's what you're going to see over and over again if you work on a large scale or massively parallel biology, and this is one of the problems that technology and the analysis has to overcome. So where is the noise coming from in microarray measurements? So this is a slide, I think you saw some sort of variation of this in Zach's talk. So this is how an affymetric DNA microarray chip works. So you start with tissue and you extract RNA. And what you do is you have to do an RT, a reverse transcriptase treatment or step on it that is going to translate back the RNA into cDNA. And depending on how you do it, you can either produce cDNA or cRNA, because during this process, when you're producing the cDNA or the cRNA, fluorescence dyes will be incorporated into the polymers, and then these are going to be hybridized to the specific probes present on the chip. Now, the underlying assumption or expectation is that ideally, one copy of a given RNA will produce one unit of a specific signal. If this were true, then you would have very accurate measurements. But now let's see what's actually happening in reality. When cDNA is produced from the RNA using the RT, this is an enzyme that has its own life, its own characteristics. So the initiation of the RT step is stochastic, because, you know, as I'm sure you're aware of that, you need a starting primer that's going to be extended by the reverse transcriptase. And very often the reverse transcriptase, the enzyme, simply drops off. So that's what you see is actually when you do a microarray measurement, you see usually a much stronger signal coming from the 3' end of the gene than from the 5' end, because as you're transcribing, reverse transcribing the message, the RT starts to fall off. So you always have much stronger signal from where the RT started, which is always the RT, because that's where what you usually use is a poly-A. You're using the poly-A tag as your initiator. You can use random primers as well, and actually sometimes it's used, for example, in bacteria, but most of the time you start with poly-A. Also, cRNA, which is used for the affymetric chip, is produced in the presence of fluorescent dyes. And it's assumed that the dye incorporation, or it is hoped that dye incorporation is going to be linear, and it's going to be incorporated with equal probability, but that's not the case. The cRNA production is not linear. There are messages that are transcribed into cRNA with a much higher probability, much higher efficiency than others, and the dye incorporation is not linear either. Also, the affymetric chips involves a step and you actually break down your cRNA. For whatever reason, this is the chip design. And breaking down the cRNA into small pieces is not going to be the same for all messages either. And of course, you have all sorts of other problems like hybridization or cross-hybridization. So, and one can go on and on and on. What would give you the noise is just a couple of samples. But the point is that your final signal is going to be the sum of all the above, or all these things and others. So this is just to give you a feel for how many individual little issues will arise when you're doing a microarray measurement. Of course, the surface chemistry is very important, the background, subtraction, and so forth. So let's see another example. This is the two-color microarray. The previous one, the Affymetrix chip you heard about last time, in which you are actually putting in a single cRNA per chip. And there was another competing technology invented at the same time. When you actually label cDNA of two different samples, you mix the two samples, and you're actually measuring the ratio for each individual gene. So in this case, what you do is you have equal amounts of labeled cDNA samples, and what you're hoping for, what you're trying to achieve, is that if a certain message is present at the same level in both samples, then the two intensity, the signals are going to be equal, so you're going to have like a kind of a yellow spot. If a gene is overexpressed or underexpressed, you're going to have a stronger red or green color. Now, what you are ending up with in these measurements is a ratio. And the problem is that actually there is no truly blank spot. You always have some sort of a background noise there. And when you are measuring the ratio, then of course that non-blank spot is going to give you some sort of a false pseudo-signal. So if you, for example, if there is a gene that is not present at all in a given sample and it's expressed in the other sample, then the ratio would be, of course, infinitely high, or it would be very, very, very high. But you never see this. You always have, since you have a certain background intensity, what you see is some sort of, let's say, 100-fold upregulation, which in fact, or in truth, might be a complete downregulation or a complete lack of that gene in one of the samples. So this is perceived by the experimental as compressing the signals. So you have a very wide dynamics of the ratios from minus infinity to plus infinity. But what you actually see, and this is where usually most of these measurements are, the ratios are cut, is 100-fold up or down regulation on either side. There are lots of experimental issues that can also contribute to the experimental noise. So this is how the Affymetrix chip is designed. You have seen this before. And what you have, since these are very short probes, 25 base pair probes, the way Affymetrix tried to overcome this problem is that they designed a set of probes along a given gene using some sort of an algorithm. And what they hoped for, that if you have lots of probes, 11 or 16 probes per gene, then from this set of probes, you can somehow estimate the true gene expression level. So this is how they are actually designing. As you see here, this is the entire gene, and you're kind of tiling the gene across unique enough sequence regions of genes. Now the problem is, and this is coming from a real measurement, that these up here are the perfect mesh probes that are supposed to measure the same gene. To some extent, you'd expect that all these expression levels, all these intensities would be equal. And very often, for most genes, for most processes, this is not the case. You have very bright and very dark probes. There are lots of reasons for this. You have cRNA secondary structure, and so forth, and so forth. But the point is that when you look a little bit harder or deeper into what you're actually getting from these measurements, well, you're expected to estimate a true gene expression level from this set of intensities that can often vary by 4 or 5 orders of magnitude. So that's how reality works in these experiments. So this is just another additional piece of information, that it's not that easy to design these chips, but of course one can improve a lot, and the gentleman sitting here could tell you lots of interesting stories about how these things are designed or how they are not designed by the manufacturer, but that's a different story. So I was just trying to give you a couple of thoughts, a couple of pieces of data about where noise is coming from in massively parallel measurements in real life. But even if you had very good quality measurements, you have other sort of conceptual issues in this field as well. So let's assume that you want to use your numbers to reverse engineer a system or to do forward modeling, more forward simulation, large genetic networks, but you'd like to have very good quality numbers. The problem is that when you do these measurements, you always measure a very heterogeneous solution, a very heterogeneous population of RNA and proteins. Now, when you start to do this measurement, how are you going to normalize your numbers? So how do you express your measurements, even if your measurement is, your technology is very good? Per unit RNA, per microgram RNA? The problem with this is that if you have a decrease in the level of a given gene, and some genes are very highly expressed, and then the message of other genes unavoidably leads to a relative increase of the level of other messages. Because let's say you have a million copies, or let's say 10 million copies per RNA per single cell. So if a highly expressed gene is downregulated, then what you perceive in your measurement is, unless you're actually trying to normalize for the actual copy numbers, that some other genes are slightly upregulated. So there are other conceptual issues as well, why you will have noise in your measurement. But as I mentioned, the real problem is, the real issue is the actual technology. Now, what you can do with that is, when you have a set of measurements, you want to take a good hard look at your data to see whether you have some sort of a systematic error in measurement. These are a bunch of affymetrics measurements, real measurements, in which what you see is the intensity distribution of all probe sets. So what you have here is the measurement, gene expression measurements, on about 10, 11,000 different genes, all covered by a different probe set. And this is what you see as a distribution. Now, what you see here is there is one measurement that's very strongly an outlier. There's some other as well. These are pretty much the same. And imagine that you're actually running the very same sample. Let's say you have a single cell line and you treat it with different drugs. Then what you'd expect is essentially the very same distribution for each of these RNA samples with a few differences, a few variations. And you have this guy here. So what you can assume, and this is actually what people usually do, and the affymetrics algorithm does, that for some reason, during this measurement, the fluorescent dye incorporation wasn't as efficient, or your fluorescent reader was miscalibrated, or something else, but a systematic error occurred. So what you assume then is that the distribution for all these measurements is actually the same. So what you can do is you can start to shift your curves, because you have a good reason to assume that these are actually all very similar distributions. So what you can do is actually you take the mean or the median or all of these curves, and you shift them to the very same mean or median, and you simply decide where you're going to shift everything else. And then based on that, you renormalize all the numbers. And when you look for differentially expressed genes, you work with those renormalized numbers. Because if you hadn't done this, then you'd say that, well, every gene is downregulated, which is obviously false. So that's what normalization is about. So normalization in general is that you don't really believe the numbers that come out of your experiments, and you hope or you assume that you can actually improve those numbers by assuming that you have a systematic error that you can correct. There are two ways of doing this. One is that you assume that most or certain things do not change. And the second one is that actually you have an error model. So the first one, that you assume that most or certain things do not change, is what you saw on the previous slide. So you say most of these distributions actually have to be very, very similar. And you can shift the means or medians of these curves. But sometimes the shape of the curve is going to be different as well. And, you can have, if you have this nonlinearity of the dye incorporation, then you not only assume that, you can assume that the curve is shifted, but the shape of the curve is going to be different as well. So you can do some sort of Cuban spline fate locus, and you can try to change the shape of the curves as well, and shift the means that most of the curves, or all the curves, would look very similar. And whatever remains as an outlier, after all this is done, is your true outlier, or what you perceive as a real outlier. And in most cases, actually, that makes a lot of sense, and it provides differential calls that can be corroborated by independent measurements. This is the similar problem for CDNA microarray measurements. In this case, the red versus green ratios are not expected to show any intensity dependence. But in most cases, when you do two-color microarray, this is what you see. So these are the intensity and this is the ratios, and you see that what you'd expect is a curve like this, and that is what you see. That means that the red and the green dye is not incorporated with the very same efficiency, especially depending on the concentration or the concentration or the individual gene species. So what you see is that for, let's say, low copy number genes, red dye is incorporated with higher efficiency than the green one. What you do in this case is actually kind of try to straighten it out, because you're assuming that, well, for all genes, the red and green incorporation should be the same. So what you're trying to do is to correct for systematic errors, and in the case when you're assuming that your basic assumption is that most things do not change, then you can choose a set of elements that will be used. That is, sometimes there is a set of housekeeping genes, which is a very shaky concept. You're assuming that certain genes do not change. Let's say metabolic genes do not change, or structural proteins, the genes associated with structural proteins do not change. Now this is used very often, as I'm sure you've seen in Northerners, that they normalize it for GAPDH or actin. Well, it's okay, it's just very difficult to find a set of genes that is really not expected to change. Or you can choose a set of special control genes that for some reason you know that those genes never change in your system. And of course, then the next step is you need to determine the normalization function, which is a global mean or median normalization or some sort of an intensity-dependent normalization. If you want to learn about this more, then actually there's a whole website and a chat room and whatnot, and it's a whole cottage industry that is trying to figure out what's the best way of normalizing microarray. The alternative is that if you come up with some idea about how the error is actually generated. So this is the most popular error model, in which it is assumed that at low concentrations you have an additive error. You have just simply a normal a white noise around your measurement. At high concentrations you have a multiplicative error, and actually for all noise you have the combination of two. So if you make these assumptions, then you can generate very good error models, and the normalization based on that actually gives you a very similar result as with the previous assumption. So actually these two methods, it seems, are interchangeable, at least for CDNA microarray. Noise will limit the useful information content of measurements. That's the problem, that's the issue, why you need to be aware of that. So it seems that if you take all these microarray measurements, then a reliable detection of two-fold differences seems to be the practical limit. So this is actually a very optimistic and not cross-platform comparison. So if you do a large number of F-matrix measurements in all sorts of, or CDNA micro-measurements, or a large number of very, very different cancer samples, then it seems that if you take all the information or all the useful information, you extract all the useful information from your measurements, it seems that a two-fold difference, a reliable detection of two-fold difference, is pretty much the limit. It's possible that certain genes are going to be measured reliably, the higher accuracy, but across all genes, probably this is the experimental limitation. And why is it an important issue? Again, getting back to the issue that you were trying to predict how your system is going to behave, let's assume that you want to figure out who is regulating whom, starting with time series measurements. So you're going to measure gene expression changes or protein changes along within a certain time frame. So how would you design your experiments? There were experiments done on the cell cycle of yeast or human fibroblasts. But of course, you have to choose your time window correctly. So if this is the error of your measurement, this solid line, then of course, you don't want to take measurements more often than the error of the experiment measurement allows you to do. So if you know how fast genes are changing and what's your experimental error, from that you can kind of determine a sensible, reliable time window which seems to be the case that, for example, in yeast, there is no point of taking more gene expression measurements more often than every 5 to 10 minutes, and in mammalian cells then more often than 15 to 30 minutes. If you measure more frequently, you're just simply going to run into noise and you're just wasting your money. So that's the reason why you need to be aware of the noise limitations, and when you know how what's your error or noise of your measurement, you can make some sort of a back of the envelope calculations of how much information you can actually extract from that measurement and what that could be enough for. So moving on to the other issue of sensitivity and completeness. When you're trying to predict what's going to happen to your system, then it's, of course, the question is that there is a trade-off, or there is like this issue of how many parameters are we measuring and how many parameters should we measure. If you try to predict whether a certain cell is going to, a certain cancer is going to metastasize or not, how many genes do you need for that? If you want to predict how a cell cycle is going to progress, how many genes do you need to measure for that? And how many are we measuring? So for that, we need to have at least some impression of how large are these networks. So this is just the, you know, showing that it's pretty large. This is like a graph representation of all interacting proteins in yeast. So in this case, you have about 5,000 proteins. Proteins, genes, protein modifications are all independently regulated, so you can call them something like bionodes. And the cautious estimate would be that for in each cell, the number of bionodes are going to be on the order of, let's say, a couple of hundred thousands. This is coming from the fact that you have 10 to 20,000 active genes per cell, and you have, let's say, less than 10 post-translational modifications per gene, per protein. And that would give you roughly this number. Of course, that could be much more and much less in terms of whether you're working with splice variants or you actually need to measure only the activity of modules. But this is probably on this order to have some sort of a complete picture. Now, we certainly don't have this so far, but this is the way technology develops. And actually, this seems to be the easiest thing to achieve. You just simply put on more and more and more gene, especially as the genome projects are being completed. And probably the coverage of the microarray chips or proteomics is going to reach the complete genome in the next couple of years. There is no real reason why it couldn't have been achieved. All you need to have is the sequence information and, you know, set up the technology. But, so the completeness can be achieved in terms of, if you work hard enough, and there are tens of thousands of biochemists and biologists working on this, you can sooner or later measure most of the biologically important parameters in the cell. At least in principle, that means that you can have a probe that would measure these. But do we actually see signals coming from these when you are using microarray measurements? And there was a gentleman, Michael Holland, who did these experiments a couple of years ago when he just simply took microarray measurements and RT-PCR measurements as well on a couple of hundred genes in yeast. And what he was interested in is one thing, one, what's the dynamic range of gene expression changes in yeast? And what he found is that the transcript abundance in yeast varies over six orders of magnitude. What actually this means is that the six orders of magnitude is very large, and you cannot see this in every single cell, because the lowest number means that 0.01 copies per cell. So what you see that certain cells will express a single copy of a gene due to stochastic noise, and only every 100th cell will express that. So this is this dynamic range of gene expression changes. He was also interested in that if he measures the gene expression level of these 300-400 genes, and he chose important genes like transcription factors, and he compares the different technologies. RT-PCR is fairly sensitive, although at very, very low concentrations you run into stochasticity, but it's probably the most sensitive technology you can use. And you compare it to microarray, then how sensitive microarray relative to RT-PCR? And that's what he saw. And what it shows you that this range of gene expression levels is completely, this is not seen by microarray. So this is well under the sensitivity of microarray. What you see is that you start to see some sort of a correlation between the microarray measurement and the RT-PCR at 2 copies per cell. So all these genes are actually expressed and changing and probably they are doing something important. As I said, most of the genes were actually transcription factors, but they are not seen by microarray. So sensitivity is a very important issue. When you do microarray measurements, well, then depending on your technology, you will have lots of genes that are going to be under the sensitivity of the technology. I'm sure, and it's, I mean, as new technologies are coming out right now, this is going to be improved as well, but this is another issue you should be aware of, that even if you do microarray measurements and you see lots of blank spots, it doesn't necessarily mean that those genes are not changing or they are not present. Simply, your measurement is not sensitive enough. So the utmost goal of the technology is going to be, of course, per single gene. But even if you are measuring everything accurately, there might be problems with predictions. And this is what I was referring to before, and just very quickly. Because you're a biologist, so what? Many years ago, actually, I think it happened here at MIT, a gentleman, Edward Lorenz, was trying to predict how the weather is going to change. It was in the 60s. And what he did is he took a few ordinary differential equations, a completely deterministic system, and he tried to predict how the outcome of this set of differential equations is going to change. And what he was really shocked to see, and a little bit later, the entire scientific community was shocked to see, that these three ordinary differential equations produced a behavior very sensitive to the initial conditions, which means that if you just change a very little, just smidgen of the starting parameters, the outcome of the measurements was completely different. And this ended up in scientific history as chaos theory, that you might have heard about bifurcations and so forth. The point is that even if you start with a seemingly completely deterministic system, you might not be able to predict how that system is going to behave because of this very fact that small changes in the initial conditions can cause huge changes at later time points. Now, we know that biology is not like that because biology is a robust system, because we are sitting here when we are talking. So many people think that a biological system is somewhere on the edge of the completely deterministic and chaotic systems. But the bottom line is that just because you can measure everything very accurately doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have a very high prediction. But let me give you a much simpler representation or example of the very same problem. Imagine that you already measured very accurately the gene expression level and at very high sensitivity of all genes or many genes in a variety of cancer samples. And what you're trying to figure out is that what are the genes that are causing cancer? And let's assume that you found this subset of cancer samples that are, these are actually real measurements from melanoma. And this is a subset of samples that is extremely malignant. Here's the patient very quickly. And you also think that you found that group of genes that's going to be responsible for that extremely malignant state. But you need to ask the question, as I referred to this before, can this be due to chance? Because you have a limited number of samples. Well, just by chance, if you randomly put in sorts of values, you can see something like this. Sometimes you can find an analytical solution, but more often you can. You need to do some sort of computational solution. So you permutate your data set and look for similar patterns. And if you never find a similar pattern, a similar group of genes in the permutated gene expression matrix, then you say, well, this is not due to chance. But this is not that obvious how to do it. So analytical solutions can be sometimes found. So let me just give you this very simple example. So this I usually poses a little problem that you can solve at home. We had this problem that at the dawn of microarray analysis, my lab measured gene expression measurements in different breast cancer cell lines. And when we reached, because it was very expensive, when we reached 6 breast cancer cell lines, we found 13 consistently misregulated genes, up or down regulated genes. And what we asked is, can this be due to chance or not? So this was translated into a combinatorics problem that you have E different cell lines and gene microarray. So the number of genes misregulated in the ith cell line. And the question was that can we find K consistently misregulated genes across all E cell lines by chance? So if you like combinatorics, this is a nice little home exercise if you want to solve. But so you can find an analytical solution for this, and this is very simple, and you know this could be solved quite easily, and you get a fairly reliable number of this. But what if more genes are involved? and more importantly, what if genes are not independently regulated? The underlying assumption in combinatorics is that you're drawing your samples randomly and independently. But in these GBAs, genes are co-regulated. If a transcription factor is upregulated, well, the downstream genes are going to be upregulated as well, or some of them will be upregulated. And this is coming from real samples, so what you see here is when you do a complete permutation, then this is going to be the distribution of correlation coefficients for each gene pair. Well, in real samples, this is what you see. So there is a high correlation of gene expression changes up and down, which is kind of obvious because this is a genetic regulated network. Now, the problem is that if you need to do this analysis and you ask the question, is my pattern random or not, or can this be present due to chance or not? Well, if you use permutated, a randomly permutated gene expression matrix as your benchmark, and in that case, your analysis or your result or your statistical analysis can be off by orders of magnitude, by 6-7 orders of magnitude, relative to an analysis when you say, well, I'm going to permutate the sample but retain the overall dependency of gene expression changes. If you do that, which is not an obvious thing to do and takes some computational tricks, now you'll have a very different result. Noise in discrete measurements. Yep. Okay, so what you have is that you found a pattern that a certain number of genes are causing, let's say, cancer. And what people usually do is they do a complete randomization. So you just swap everybody, and then you look for the same pattern and you don't find it. You never find the five genes that would show the same pattern, okay? And then you are happy. Now, the problem is that this has completely destroyed this permutation, the codependence of genes. Right? And in reality, that means that if you have codependence, imagine that there are certain genes that are very strongly co-regulated and other genes are never co-regulated, that the ones that are actually co-regulated are not actually two independent genes, but in your analysis, that should be one, you could replace it by one gene, right? And this is what you should retain. Of course, you don't have complete co-regulation and complete independence, but you have a distribution of correlation coefficients. That's what you see here. So the way one should do this is create a large number of random matrices in which the distribution of correlation coefficients is something like this, but apart from that, it's random. And then ask the question, is my pattern present in this as well? Now, if you compare the statistical power or the statistical confidence between these two matrices, you can be off by 5-6 orders of magnitude. So something is significant in this is way below significance in this. So that's the point. It's not that obvious how to do these things, but it's just an important point that sometimes even if you have good quality measurements, biology is going to present you with very difficult problems. And this is actually present in sequence measurements. I mean, the whole BLAST issue is about this as well. So moving on to noise in discrete measurements, which is the best example, the easiest example is actually DNA sequences. So of course you have measurement error there as well. You have sequencing errors with a certain probability, let's say, now it's probably down to 0.1%, but it used to be like between 0.1% and 1%. Of course, the solution was a sequence a lot. Of course, if you see a difference in your sequencing and it's not done with a single individual, you're not quite sure whether you're seeing a single nucleotide polymorphism, a SNP, or a sequencing error. But if you work hard enough and sequence enough, you will have some sort of a feel about the true sequence of a DNA sequence. Now, you end up with a very, very, very long stretch of layers. Right? In the case of humans, it's 3 billion. And what you need to achieve, or what is expected from you, is to find genes, introns, exons, transcription factor binding sites in this sea of 4 layers. Now, how do you do that? This is going to be an issue of noise as well. If you had only genes, like exons and introns, or only exons and transcription factor binding sites, it would be very easy to find. The problem is that you have lots of sort of junk DNA or intergenic regions. You have no idea what they are doing, and in those, sometimes seemingly intelligible information will show up just by chance. So help can be found. That's why the real way of building genomes is not only DNA sequencing, because from that, it's very difficult to find the number of genes. Actually, if you look hard in the literature about the number of genes, usually the number of genes keeps falling with time, because actually they see that there are lots of erroneous predictions. Usually these gene prediction algorithms tend to err on the side that would give you, on a more liberal side. It tends to give you more genes than actually is present. So what you're looking for is actually cDNA, for example, cDNA libraries from the same organism, because those are the truly expressed genes. So you try to bring together the two different databases, and if you find a cDNA, well, that cDNA can help you to find the actual genes. Now, the problem is that then cDNA has to be expressed. And if you didn't happen to prepare a cDNA library from the cell line in which that gene is expressed, well, then you won't have that gene in your cDNA library, therefore you cannot find it in your genome. So help can be found, and this, the DNA sequence information can be refined to a large extent by all sorts of different databases, data sources, but there are lots of unexpected issues in biology, which are truly amazing. They were completely unexpected, and you'd have never been able to come up with that idea simply based on primary sequence information. And let me just give you two really shocking pieces of data that are actually pretty recent. One is the widespread occurrence of antisense transcription in the human genome. Why did these guys do it? Why? It's a long story. But what they found actually, that they found in the human genome about 1,600 actually transcribed antisense transcription units. So you know usually how the sense, how the genome is read and transcribed in the sense way. Maybe just looking into it, whether things are transcribed in the antisense way. I mean, you heard a lot about microRNA, siRNA, regulatory RNA, so there was a good reason why they were looking into this. Nobody would have expected that there is such a high number of actual antisense transcription units. Also, when a group checked out what portion of a given chromosome is actually transcribed, they were kind of surprised to see that it was about one order of magnitude more than expected. What people usually do is you take a chromosome, in case they check chromosome 21 and 22, you know where the majority of exons or introns are, and based on that you expect that the exons are going to be transcribed, and maybe a couple of regulatory RNAs. So you have an expectation that, let's say, a couple of percent of your chromosome, of a given chromosome, is transcribed. Now, what they found when they actually covered the entire chromosome by an FFmatrix chip is actually 10 times as much information was transcribed from the DNA than expected based on exons. Again, you wouldn't have been to predict this just simply based on primary sequence information. So, but what can you do? You have this sea of information that seems to you noise, so is there a way to deal with this? So let's assume that you need to find a transcription factor binding site. It's going to be something like TGG-ACT. Of course, you don't know that this is TGG-ACT. And of course, it's not always TGG-ACT. It can be TGC-ACT, because transcription factor binding sites like to play with sequence, and actually, this is the way they can change their affinity to a given, or specificity to a given sequence. So then this is going to be your actual sequence that it can bind to. So this is what you're ending up. This is what you're looking for, that you don't know that this is your binding site. And you're trying to add constraints. So this is one trick. You say transcription factor binding sites are usually within 500 base pairs upstream from the start codon of a given gene. And you also know that it tends to cluster in the same region. So for most transcription factor binding sites, you have more than one. So what you might be doing is you say, I'm looking for certain, let's say, 6 base pair long sequences that tend to cluster within 500 base pair of ATGs. And then you're going to find something. But still, this is going to be very, very weak. You have way more layers, way more information than and way more noise from which than the level from which you could expect the important information. So even if you do all this, you will find that many obviously transcription factor binding site-looking sequences do not function as such. Well, why we do not quite understand yet, yeah, due to higher level of DNA regularization, whatnot. And of course, the problem is that you do not know what sequence to start with. So what can you do? You can hope that your statistical overrepresentation will help. And one trick is provided by nature, which is cross-species conservation. So you have extremely noisy, we call them noisy, but of course they are not noisy, extremely noisy genomes, human, chimp, mouse, rat, yeast, or whatnot. And you're assuming, and this assumption is a fair assumption, that you have a cross-species conservation of important sequences. So what you're looking for are there sequences that are conserved across several species. And if you combine all this with some sort of smart tools like using artificial intelligence, machine learning, HMM, hidden marker models were extremely useful to find, for example, gene identification, then you might start to see some pattern emerging. And this was done for yeast by Eric Lendl's group. So this just gives you a concrete example that showed that this is actually a very efficient way to go. When they sequenced four yeast species, four very closely related sequence, yeast species, the original number of genes in each of them was about 5,500. The reason they did it is because they knew that these were very similar species. So what they found is actually there is a very high level of synteny of genes. So what they found is that this shows that same gene is present at the same location in all of these species. The order changes, sometimes the gene is lost, gained, especially at the chromosomes around telomeres or subtelomeric regions, there's a lot of turbulence going on. But for the most of the chromosomes, things are, or the information is retained to a large extent. Of course, there is slow and rapid evolution. They found that for certain very important genes, there's 100% nucleotide conservation across all species. For others, there is a very low level of conservation. Probably that's something that nature can afford to experiment with. But the bottom line is what they were doing is actually they found that important transcription factor binding sites are going to be present at the very same location across all species. So what they were looking for here is that actually this is GAL4 binding site, and this shows you the four different species, and it shows this is at the very same location in all different species. This is the Tata box, the GAL4 binding site. It's another Tata box. So it shows that you have a very high conservation of important regulatory information. Now, what you can do is actually turn this around and look for unknown information. And what you do is, what they did is let's generate, or they generated all random sequences, which was XYZ, that means that X, Y, and Z stands for any of ATC, ATCG, and ABC, and there is any number of random ATCs between them, between 0 and 21. You can do this. This is within the realm of scientific computation. This is actually not a lot. So these are any combination. And you look for certain statistically significant patterns for this. One of them is intergenic conservation. Are there any sequences like this, when you go through all sequences, that tend to be conserved between genes, at intergenic regions? You can check for intergenic versus genic conservation, or you can check for upstream versus downstream conservation. These are all statistical benchmarks they found for known transcription factor binding sites. So what they found, that for known transcription factor binding sites, all these, you have those are more conserved in intergenic conservation. You have a higher intergenic versus genic conservation and upstream versus downstream conservation. So recall the problem. You're starting with any random sequence. You're just trying to figure out whether any of these random sequences have any biological significance. Now, even more importantly, what they found is that when you start to find statistically significantly retained or conserved sequences, then these motifs were also enriched in front of genes that tended to share function, which is very important, because you're assuming that there are certain functional modules, so genes that tend to do the same thing has to be turned on or off at the same time, or the same under the same conditions. So that's when they came up with a long list of potential transcription factor binding sites, in which all these things were kind of pulled together, and they found that these are sequences that tend to be conserved in front of genes that tend to share function. And many of these actually were confirmed independently by experiments as new true transcription factor binding sites. So the bottom line is that in these measurements, either even in discrete measurements, that means sequencing, you will have to face a lot of sort of noise. Biological organisms were built a long time ago, and the blueprints were lost. If you knew how it was built, then you could figure out what's important and what not. But everything was experimented a long time ago. Now, so it seems to you now that right now the important information is hidden in a sea of irrelevant information. And it will be very difficult, and usually it's impossible to find based on solely computational ground. But if you look for help from actual biology, in this case cross-species conservation, well, then the important things, the gold nuggets, start to emerge. Okay, and that's it. Any questions?